Welcome to The Brainstorm, a podcast and video series from ARK Invest. Tune in every week as we react to the latest in innovation and reflect on how short-term news impacts our long-term views. To learn more, visit ARK-invest.com.
ARK Investment Management, LLC is an SEC-registered investment advisor. ARK and Public are unaffiliated entities and do not have a relationship with respect to either firm marketing or selling the products or services of the other, and therefore ARK disclaims responsibility for any loss that may be incurred by Public's clients or customers. The information provided in this show is for informational purposes only and should not be used as the basis for any investment decision and is subject to change without notice. It does not constitute either explicitly or implicitly any provision of services or products by ARK. An investor should determine for themselves whether a particular investment management service is suitable for their investment needs. All statements made regarding companies or securities are strictly beliefs and points of view held by ARK and/or show guests and are not endorsements by ARK of any company or security or recommendations by ARK to buy, sell, or hold any security. Historical results are not indications of future results. Certain of the statements contained in the show may be statements of future expectations and other forward-looking statements that are based on ARK's current views and assumptions and involve known and unknown risks and uncertainties that could cause actual results, performance, or events to differ materially from those expressed or implied in such statements. ARK assumes no obligation to update any forward-looking information. ARK and its clients, as well as its related persons, may, but do not necessarily, have financial interests in securities or issuers that are discussed. Certain information was obtained from sources that ARK believes to be reliable. However, ARK does not guarantee the accuracy or completeness of any information obtained from any third party.
Welcome to The Brainstorm, episode 67. Key question to kick it all off: is Google's profit center under attack? And then we'll jump topics to life-saving cures and why that is good business and why I'm very confused why people don't think it's good business. But that's for later down. Nick, what was the topic you brought up? Frame it, and then we'll get Brett to weigh in.
Yeah, I think it's a topic that is more of a AI roundup because you have so much news coming out in such a short period of time. And this news cycle on AI is more focused around search. You have a number of different players, Perplexity, OpenAI, and even Meta is throwing their hat in the ring potentially on AI search. And I think it is a unique time in history because Google has, with their search product, been almost untouchable for the last decade plus. And now you have new types of engines and capabilities coming out of the large language model space, and providers are starting to show some potential cracks in Google's moat and how they approach search. And so you have Perplexity, which has gained traction. If you look at the numbers they post on X, you know, they're definitely starting to take off and resonate with consumers. OpenAI just released last week SearchGPT, and then there was rumors of Meta going after the search market. We don't have much information there. But I think, you know, that summarizes at a high level what is happening. And then just to get into what I think is the most important detail is why AI search and not what we're traditionally accustomed with what Google provides. And I think the fundamental difference, if you've used one of these products at a very high level, when you search for something on Google, it's typically very links-based in terms of the result that you get. So you search for something, and then you get a bunch of different links that have potential answers for what you are asking for. When it comes to AI, when what you see from Perplexity and OpenAI is the model itself is actually going to all of those potential different links and then summarizing an answer for you. So it's inherently more text rich and giving you a response that feels more natural versus, you know, having to then do a kind of a secondary search when it comes to Google. If you think about it, you're going, you're searching, and then you have to go search within the links to find exactly what you're looking for. Whereas AI, the promise is that it just delivers exactly what you're looking for in more of a text rich response. And so this is the promise. Obviously, there's some, you know, fallbacks or there's some hiccups today with AI search, hallucinations being one. I think that, you know, is worth discussing and there's some merit to it. But over the long term, you kind of assume, given the performance improvements we've seen, that it's going to, you know, that won't be a problem in the future. It is today. It won't be, I think, in the future. But this is, I think, the total summation of what we've seen in the last week and maybe 2 years of kind of following this space.
All right. So that's a good description. Nick, you're our resident Apple alarmist. Brett, you're our Google alarmist. Google, Nick, they're starting to do what you say, right? Like they're bringing stuff into the knowledge graph. Brett, why should Google feel threatened?
Well, I mean, anytime you have a dominant franchise that has practically been unimpeachable, that basically people can throw billions of dollars at the wall and it doesn't put a dent into your profitability, then a fundamental change in consumer behavior should necessarily be concerning, because the entire kind of business rationale of search and cost per click and all of the associated processes and sets of expertise that Google has built up is potentially going to depreciate, whereas before it seemed like it might last forever. And so though Google can and does layer in kind of language model search results, even above their traditional search results in some searches, at least for me, and I think it's true for the two of you, my first look when I'm looking for that my kind of material is either Perplexity or ChatGPT, because it's my habit of how I get information in that way. And then I use Google as like a second or third resort of, well, now I need to like verify a specific fact that I'm not sure if the language model is mangled. And I don't like the links that SearchGPT or Perplexity has provided me. And so, I mean, Google's search business is like one of the historically best businesses ever generated. It generates huge, you know, profitable revenue volumes, particularly when measured on the amount of time consumers spend on the product, because basically they go there to go somewhere else and Google charges a toll. I think it's pretty clear that the direction that things are going with even the current state of AI and as AI agents become more able to do stuff for you is that rather than going somewhere and then being led somewhere else, you are going to live in that spot where your answers are being provided. Now, Google could provide that, but it's clear that on a marginal basis, Perplexity and OpenAI's products are doing that. And Meta has this huge distribution footprint across which they could push that capability. And that would be potentially severely endangering to Google, given kind of their deep pockets, their distribution, and the great language models they're producing.
I feel like it's interesting then to dive into, right? Each of these competitors or potential disruptors have a different set of business models and execution worries or risks, right? You have Perplexity and OpenAI, both not profitable to my knowledge, right? And so it's like they need to keep investing and reliant on capital markets believing their story to keep going and even threatening. Meta, much more stable and orthogonal. Maybe not that orthogonal, right? It's still advertising, but you know, they control their own destiny with regards to attacking them. And then there's also discussion, you know, totally low-end disruptor of, you know, AI chatbots and whether that's going to disrupt here. How do you think about all of these? Like, you know, are the big just going to keep getting bigger here, particularly when you need to invest $50 billion a year to stay at the lead?
I'll give my opinion, Brett, and I'd like to hear yours. I think, and I like the way that you frame this. I think when you pull back and look at what's happening, I think the first thing you can admit in what is happening today, search is inherently more competitive than it has been really since the early innings of it. It's like we've gone full circle and now search is now competitive again. But does that necessarily mean Google's business will deteriorate? And that, I think, is an open question, because Google has its own product in the market, which Brett alluded to. And so the question is, can Google disrupt itself or transition that very large amount of revenue over to this new type of results that, you know, they're showing when people are searching? And that question, it could possibly be yes. I think they gave a statement on the most previous earnings call last week saying that the CPM rates they're getting on Gemini and what they're seeing there in those, you know, tested AI results are in line with what they typically see in traditional search. And so that's a great sign if you're someone looking at Google and saying, okay, you know, this revenue bucket is still very much going to be there for Google. I mean, they grew revenue 10% on their search business this past quarter. So these new incumbents, when you look at OpenAI and Perplexity, they've made waves. And I think it's important to pull our own perspective out of this because we're in the weeds. We're doing more with search and AI than most, just given the nature of our jobs. And we're probably not the right people to poll in terms of how we use these. I love Perplexity. I love OpenAI and ChatGPT. But I don't think everyone out there is going to just download a new application and hand over all of their search to these new incumbents if Google can get it right. And that's really the, and it's a timing question. And then it's a monetization question to Brett's point where, you know, your timing has to be right. You have to have a competitive product in the market and you need to not disrupt yourself enough to upset your shareholders. We've seen this in one of my spaces, which is cable and to streaming. You have companies like Disney that are trying to transfer their linear business and advertising dollars in linear over to the streaming space. And I think that's what's going to play out in search. You need to transfer all of that traditional search spend over into this new AI bucket. And that's a tricky problem. And it's kind of like a tightrope you need to walk in order to not show, you know, disastrous earnings one quarter and then have everyone up in arms. And so I think that is the way that I think about it because they're open questions. Meta, entirely different camp because they own and operate an entire corner of the internet that none of these products have access to. Like having native search embedded into Instagram and unifying their backend algorithms to have more productivity when users are spending time on the platform. Like there's a whole uplift that Meta can see just by creating better search within its core products before it even needs to introduce something that goes and explores the rest of the open internet. So like I would bucket that in its own camp because there is upside for Meta without even having to compete in this space. I think they're just throwing their hat in the ring to see what kind of appetite's out there because they see what we see, which is search is now competitive. There's democratization happening. Might as well have a product in the market because we're spending tens of billions of dollars training these models, and it's very applicable to the space.
Yeah, and I think if you look at history, it's unlikely that the way Google search gets imperiled is the direct competitor against search like immediately begins to erode it because it can respond to that, right? And so it'll, you know, be a series of maybe their defensive actions. It's probably less profitable, even though they're generating same revenue per query. They're probably spending more on each query, so it's less profitable to them. But usually the thing that's the head-to-head competitor is not the way in which an incumbent loses. It's the approach that doesn't even look like search, but it meets that same consumer need in a way that kind of like short circuits the I'm going to go to a search engine behavior of the consumer. So Meta, or you brought up chatbots, Sam, like that's an example where if you have an AI girlfriend, she's going to tell you what shoes to buy. You're not going to go and search what shoes to buy. She's going to say, I like Adidas, and you're going to buy Adidas. And it's not going to be cost per click. It's going to be cost per influence that's paid for that Adidas preference and that AI bot. And so you don't even need to go to the search engine to find the Adidas because she'll happily serve them up to you. This is the one I like. It's from this store. I'm getting you a great price, you know, like, and so it kind of like, I think you could see the commercial behavior that is search's real engine of revenue generation just fragmenting across, well, maybe it all goes to Meta, or fragmenting across a number of different experiences that happen to be hosting, you know, Meta-driven or Llama-driven AI bots, or OpenAI or Anthropic-driven AI bots, or directly through the ChatGPT interface. And so it's kind of like search. I like the analogy that you just brought up, like linear to streaming. It's like linear to streaming was its own war, and Netflix basically won. But it took a long time, a lot of head-to-head battling, a lot of uncertainty around whether Netflix would survive. If you reran the simulation a bunch of times, I'm not sure that Netflix, like what percentage of the time Netflix ends up in a dominant position versus just like getting eaten alive, right? But what the real war that was never fought but is definitely lost was linear TV versus YouTube and TikTok and Instagram and all of the other ways that consumer attention just got captured, video games. And I think same with search. Information seeking is going to clearly move from I'm looking for information, then I'm going to dig through these links to find information, to I want information that actually has been pre-processed for me in some way, that where a lot of the work that previously I had to do, I'm outsourcing to some other thing. And that could be, you know, get me the cheapest batteries, or it can get be like, find me a unique, I don't know, prom dress. It can be plan my vacation. And that could live in all kinds of other places rather than there being this specific kind of like, I'm looking for a data point front end that people currently rely on. And so I think that's kind of like the way in which this likely evolves, is Google is successfully positioning themselves as battling off these search competitors while they're losing a larger war that they're not necessarily even directly able to focus on within the context of their search business.
All right. So then to sum it up, if I can, search, it's democratized. It's like, is there a monopoly? No more. But is this an immediate thing to worry about? Potentially not. This, right? It's like,
well, immediate in that kind of like the predictability and the idea that Google's search earnings are extremely predictable, stable, and going to continue to grow is probably embedded in not just the stock price, like the stock might take a while, but also the culture of that organization. And so how the organization responds to kind of marginal deterioration there, you know, they could respond well or could respond poorly. Certainly the internal politics could get really nasty and distract from other things they need to be focused on. And with companies with that big a balance sheet can do a lot along the way just to stabilize themselves. They have so much money. They can buy back shares. They can pay out a dividend, which is, they're doing both, by the way, you know, and
they can, like, they can raise money for Waymo at a 300 times multiple.
Yeah. Well, yes, yes. And they have other business lines, like YouTube is super interesting. You know, GCP and their TPU business is interesting. You know, on the AI side, their Gemini models are credible, albeit maybe third-ish place. You know, so they do have other business lines that are interesting. I think there is a, if you look at the history of organizations, when they have a massively profitable franchise that is growing and stable, and that begins to fall apart, it tends to have like collateral damage all across the organization as it responds to that. There's no guarantee that happens to Google, but I think, you know, there's a reasonable case at least that the future is more volatile than the past has been for them.
All right. So then we'll go on. Nick, did you want to say one last thing?
Yeah, I would just, it is definitely important what Google is doing today, because even if the, you know, true competition is a number of years away, the positioning and how they approach it today will matter about, you know, in the, it will matter how they're able to defend off competition down the road. And I think, you know, one company we didn't talk about and one concept we've talked about in the past, but I think applies here, and I'll end it on this, is where does search actually embed itself in this new world? Because I think part of what we've been talking about is, you know, all of this could happen at a new operating system level, which sits atop the mobile ecosystem and the kind of current web ecosystem we're accustomed to today. And if that happens, if there is an operating system level shift where the large language model itself is the new operating system, then this, you know, what we're talking about today doesn't actually really matter, because that can only be played by a handful of people. Because, you know, Sam, you brought it up in the beginning, to train these frontier models, it's just more and more expensive. It's, you know, it started at 10, now we're at 20, 30, $40 billion to get, you know, the new next frontier model. And if that's where we're heading, then, you know, these smaller players just won't have enough capital to really, you know, make inroads there. So that is important to understand. I think it depends on how large of a shift this really is.
Yeah. I'm going to say I like the AI girlfriend vector of disruption. I think people underestimate that. All right, but now we'll go on to the next topic. Brett, you'll tee this up for us, and Nick and I will definitely play dumb. All these questions are certainly, no. Yeah, we're going to ask the very basic questions here as well. But set it up for us about curing disease and why you think the market's mispricing it so dramatically.
Yeah. So there's the, with the new kind of molecular tools that, drug developers have, we're now clearly entering a stage where a lot of rare diseases are going to have prospective cures get tested on humans and likely get approved. So there's one, it's going to generate first revenue this quarter called Casgevy. It cures sickle cell disease. And so you get a one-time treatment. It's kind of like a big ordeal to get the treatment. But by doing so, somebody with sickle cell disease can avoid, you know, like tens of hospitalizations per year and get fundamentally cured of, what is like a painful life-shortening disease. There are others out there. Many, the Casgevy one is a gene editing based technology. Intellia has a gene editing based technology. They just reported phase two results. It seems to, for 80% or 70 to 80% of patients, provide a cure for a disease called the hereditary angioedema, which is also a disease you don't want. And you know, it causes hospitalizations and you have these acute swelling events. It can be mortal. It seems like for, you know, 7 or 8 out of 10 patients, they get a one-time injection and they don't have to worry about any of that again. As far as I can tell, the wisdom on Wall Street is that cures make for good for humans, bad for business. And the argument is, well, if you put a cure into the marketplace, well, good for you, but then every patient you dose is a patient that will never pay you again. And it's much better to prescribe a drug to someone where you're prescribing it monthly, because then you get those juicy ongoing revenue streams that Wall Street loves. And so we've done work to show actually that misunderstands the economics of the business. On a very simple basis, like for like, if I have a precision therapy that abates all of the symptoms of the disease, it effectively cures it, but I have to continue dosing the patient monthly for it to work. And I compare to a cure that cures all of the, you know, cures the disease. So it has the same patient outcome, except the patient no longer has to take monthly injections. Actually, that cure is a little more than 2 times more valuable. And it's for, sorry, go on.
Oh, just Wall Street is like the king of net present valuing. So why does this not compute? What are the factors at play such that you can't say, okay, one shot that, you know, you never need to take again is the same value as 20 shots over the next 5 years?
Yes. As far as I can tell, the reason people aren't underwriting these assets very well is because the assets haven't like existed in the marketplace to date. As in, this is a new way that drugs will work. And yes, Wall Street is the king of net present valuing, but it is also the, you know, the ace of not modeling something that they haven't seen before. And so the argument against, hey, you're curing patients, this is bad, you no longer have customers, is that cures command pricing. So insurers will pay for a cure based upon the lifetime cost that the patient was going to undertake. So for hereditary angioedema, for example, those patients take $500,000 worth of drugs per year just to manage the disease today. And so that's actually, those drugs are overpriced relative to fair pricing. But we think a cure for that disease should be able to cost $3 million a year. And it would still be a net savings to the insurer. And it would change, you know, meaningfully change the quality of the patient's life, as in every life year you live with that disease is worth 0.80% of a life year given the time you spend in a hospital and stuff. It improves that to 100%. So
and
you get
right. And so yes. that's what we think. What does the insurer think? And it's like, right, so it's like you said, the first revenue's coming this quarter for Casgevy, was it?
Yeah.
And so it's like, what, so then what has the insurer agreed to with regards to pricing? Are they thinking of it the same way we are, or are we saying something different?
No, the insurers, at least thus far, agree on pricing. And we actually suspected that there would be pushback from insurers. So Casgevy is being reimbursed, we believe, at about It's a little more than $2 million per dose. And it's because you're avoiding, you know, $100,000 plus in it's actually the drugs aren't that expensive. It's all the hospitalizations and going, you know, all of the inpatient care. So stuff that's very hard to cost reduce that these patients experience. So the way in which the math works is it's how much costs are you avoiding over the course of the patient's life, net present value using a discount rate. And there's a formula for how much you're extending somebody's quality adjusted life that you also net present value. So you can think of from an insurer's perspective, it's kind of like I can allocate money to any of these things. It's always cheaper to let somebody die, but I have to agree that I'm going to keep people alive. That's my job. And so the usual math they use is around $100,000 per life year that they assign to, if you can extend somebody's life for a year, you're allowed to spend $100,000 on a drug to do that, which is morbid, but it's the way the math works. And so for Casgevy, for the sickle cell disease, 2.2 million seems to be, the insurers don't have a problem with it. It's partly because these are rare diseases. So kind of like the total cost of addressing sickle cell disease is not giving them heartburn compared to like the cost of everybody trying to take one of these weight loss drugs, which are also expensive.
That's going to be my question. Because then it's like, if you do that math, Ozempic's probably wildly underpriced, right?
You mean it should be more expensive? Oh, because it provides all of these ongoing benefits.
Right. Well, it's ongoing benefits. It's reducing like all of the deaths associated with, you know, obesity or hospital visits from cardiovascular events. I don't know.
Potentially. I mean, I think, you know, the Ozempic manufacturer is around going around trying to demonstrate it helps with all these things so they can increase prescription volumes. And they can, so there's an organization in the US, it's called ICER, that it goes and does the math on how much a drug should cost. Or what the value of the drug should be given kind of life year extension plus reduction in mortality and morbidity. And so they lay out like basically a scorecard. And usually the payers will follow those scorecards and say like, okay, that's fair, then we'll pay this.
Is there with Ozempic and other drugs, you typically have a period of time, or maybe you can help me understand this, where you have, you know, first to market and then you get the generic versions hit the market. What does that look like in the cure space? Is that something they would have to deal with, or do they essentially, once you cure, you then have a monopoly on that cure?
Yeah, so that's the other important dynamic, or there's two other important dynamics for why cures are more valuable than something that does the same thing that you're dosing monthly. Cures, they pull forward all of the lifetime revenue of any patient they prescribe. And so that essentially denies that patient from the pool that becomes competitively intense 4 or 5 years after the drug has been launched. So if you look at the typical revenue curve of a typical, like a traditional drug, it's like a layer cake where you prescribe patients, they keep taking, you set up another set of patients and it layers up, and then you hit the patent cliff and competitors enter the market. And then the patients you're already prescribing, you have to cut your prices to keep them, and incremental patients are at an even lower price. So the way we model a cure is, well, you capture, you don't get a layer cake. Every set of patients you address is like a spike in the revenue graph. And so you kind of like spike very early and you're roughly flat as you're addressing patients. And then you hit the patent cliff and yes, your pricing on new patients falls down, but you've already captured the lifetime value for those patients that you've already dosed. And it may even work out where you kind of penetrate enough of the market that competitors, you know, once you cure a disease, nobody's going to want to develop a drug for that disease anymore. You know, it's kind of like you will deny competitive entry to some competitors if you effectively address enough of the people that have that disease such that it's not an attractive market for additional participants. Though we don't make assumptions about that. The combination of moving your revenue up front, so you get cash flow earlier because pricing is at a premium based on the value, and then avoiding, at least on the set of patients that you address when that competitive cliff hits, the loss of revenue that you would otherwise incur, is why the cures end up being a little more than 2 times more valuable than a traditional treatment, even a precision therapy that's doing like the same thing for the patient as the cure.
And then what's the third dynamic?
Well, it's pricing. It's moving. It's the present value of moving the revenue up front. Right. And then it's avoiding the patent cliff.
Gotcha.
So
how long are
relative to the, like for most rare diseases, there's not a drug that really works, right? Like for even the hereditary angioedema, the drug that's in market that costs $500,000 per life year, it improves quality of life over the course of the patient's life by a half life year. Basically, you get an extra half year of quality. So rather than getting, I think it's 18 years of quality adjusted lifespan, you get 18 and a half. And it costs $500,000 per year just because it's so expensive when people aren't taking that drug to deal with these acute swelling events. And there's all kinds of, you know, and so this is, you know, if anything, $3 million would be a discount, like a bargain relative to the current spend on that disease.
Is it profitable enough, or is the pricing, I know the pricing is based on life year and stuff like that, but they're also rare diseases. It's like, how does it pan out where, like, what percentage of the rare disease population need to sign up and get this such that the manufacturer of the drug
gets recouped
on?
Yeah. How early, another question here, Brett, how early can you dose someone with a rare disease? Assuming some of these rare diseases you may be born with, can you just dose child with this so that they never have to deal with this for their entire life? Or do you have to wait to a certain age? How does that work?
Yeah, you should be able to dose as early as you detect it. So with, you know, diagnosing children with, you know, full whole genome genetic diagnostic testing at birth may result in a number of these diseases that would otherwise show up later in life never happening, because then you inject them with the cure as they get it. Right now, what's interesting right now is if you imagine Intellia or any of these companies developing cures right now, you have the entire population of people living with the disease. Then you have an incident population that's quite small. And so there's a big market opportunity in being like, I'm delivering a cure to, you know, if the disease leaves you average lifespan, then it's like to a market that's 70 times larger than the incident population market. And then once you've gotten that in play, then the incident population probably becomes your recurring revenue stream. But that of itself is like not a super attractive market. So when I talk to analysts, one of the things they say, well, Zolgensma, which is a cure that a big pharma company came out with and has underperformed expectations. The issue with Zolgensma is it was just for essentially babies under the age of 2. To be dosed with. And they are trying to expand the label so they can give it to people that are older so they can address that whole population that's out there. But they're only generating a mere $1.5 billion on dosing that incident population. And so people are disappointed in that. But if you do the math, that's like half of the addressable market that they've managed to hit in a year or two. So hereditary angioedema, there's 7,000 people out there at 3 million a dose or 2.5 million a dose, call it 3 million. This is in the US, that's a $20 billion market. If you could hit half of that in a couple years, that's $10 billion in revenue. It's like a huge, huge number. It would be a massive blockbuster drug. There's probably, you know, twice that market available globally. So I think people are using poor analogies to things that just address an incident population as opposed to the whole population out there to say that these have to be small. Now, for some rare diseases, it won't make sense to develop a cure because you still have to go through all of the pain and process of developing a drug. And then the end population is just not big enough to support all of the upfront capital. But we've looked at the average rare disease in the US that is of sufficient size that you can calculate like a prevalent population. And on average, on the old, like typical prescription drugs, you would only get $100 million in net present value for developing an asset against it. So nobody's going to do that. It costs $1 billion to develop a drug. No wonder rare diseases don't have anything going after them. If you do a precision therapy that's like regularly dosed, then on average, you'd get, it's around $900 million in net present value. So you're still probably upside down, depending on how expensive it is. Like the average drug costs $1 billion, given all the fails and stumbles along the way. But a cure on the average rare disease is $2.3 billion net present value. So if you're spending $1 billion to develop a drug and you get $2.3 billion in cash flow on the back end, that's a great business, you know? And so it actually, these technologies and cures in particular, bring on board like the ability to capitalize efforts to address all these diseases that previously people were like, well, I could do it. It might be good, but it was a bad business. Now rare disease is becoming a good business really for the first time.
All right. So if you're listening, send this to your favorite biotech genomics sell side analyst. Let us know where we mistaken.
Yes, I'm very curious.
Waiting for the money to come, right? Yeah, or is it show me the money story?
I am very curious. I have not had somebody like give me the convincing argument how I'm wrong. So I really want to hear, like, I really want to know what is wrong about this analysis. So if anybody thinks I'm wrong, please,
our YouTube let me comments know. Love to point out where we're wrong. So hopefully they can deliver on this one.
Okay. Constructive feedback, please.
constructive is always good. All right. Brett, Nick, thank you for another great episode. And it's a exciting day. Tomorrow we'll have an election. It's turning pitch black now at 4 p.m. in the evening. What a time of year.
All right. Thank you, everyone.
Thanks.